Biggles was whistling softly as he walked into the breakfast room of his flat in Mount Street. It broke off as he reached for a bulky package with Canadian stamps lying beside his plate. Across the top was printed in block letters, "Confidential. If away, please forward." "What's Wilkes doing in Canada, I wonder?" murmured Algy from the other side of the table. Biggles glanced up. "Been doing a bit of Sherlock Holmes stuff with my correspondence, eh?" "Well, as I happen to know Wilkes Fitz, and am able to recognise a Canadian stamp when I see one, I put two and two together," replied Algy casually. "Who's Wilkes?" Ginger asked Algy. He had finished his breakfast and was sitting by the fire. "Wilkes, or rather Captain Wilkinson, was a flight commander in 187 Squadron in France," answered Algy. "He was an officer in the Bolivian Air Force when we last saw him. I wonder what sent him up north." Biggles read the letter to the end before laying it on the table beside him. "Poor old Wilkes is in a jam," he said quietly. "What's the trouble?" asked Algy. Biggles picked up the letter again. "Listen to this. The letter's headed Arctic Airways, Fort Beaver, Canada. My dear Biggles, as you probably remember, letter writing is not in my line, so you no doubt guessed before you opened this that things must be pretty sticky. Believe me, they're all that, and more. Before I start my story, I may as well say that the odds seem to be against my being alive by the time you get this. If I just disappear, or get wiped out in what looks like a genuine crash, find a fellow named Mac Bain, Brindle Jake, he is called around these parts, and hand him a bunch of slugs from me, as a last service from an old pal. By gosh, things must be pretty grim for old Wilkes to write in that strain," broke in Algy. "Grim is the right word for it," said Biggles shortly. "But don't interrupt, just listen to this. You remember that I was in Bolivia a few years ago. Well, there was a change of government, and as I didn't like the new one, or maybe the new one didn't like me, I packed my valise, headed north, and ultimately drifted into Canada. One day I struck lucky and got a charter job flying a mining engineer up to some new goldfields for an outfit called the Moose Creek Goldfields Corporation. You may have heard of the last place on Earth. Well, I can tell you where it is. Moose Creek. It's well inside the Arctic Circle, though why they call it Moose Creek, I don't know. For no moose in its right mind would go within 100 miles of the perishing place. But that's by the way. Having got the lowdown about these goldfields, I had one of my rare inspirations. Oh, that's old Wilkes for you," said Algy. Moose Creek is 800 miles north of the nearest railhead, and the journey, made by canoe in summer and dog sled during the freeze-up, takes about 6 weeks, heavy going. It struck me that since there was certain to be a fair amount of traffic to and from the goldfields, an airline might be worked up into a paying proposition. In an aircraft, the journey could be done in a day instead of 6 weeks. To cut a long story short, I put all my savings into the venture, opening up my own landing field at Fort Beaver, which is the railhead. I called it Arctic Airways. I got into the money, and with my profits bought a second machine. Then, listen to this, out of the blue, another fellow jumped my claim. The same Brindle Jake that I've already mentioned. It seemed a bit thick after all I'd been through, but I figured that there ought to be enough money in the game for the two of us. However, Brindle had his own ideas about that. He decided that two in the game was one too many, and he wasn't going to be the one to go. From that moment, I learned that the gloves were off. There is only one possible landing ground within 50 miles of Fort Beaver, and that's mine. I bought the land off a fellow named Angus Sterling, who had decided that he preferred prospecting for gold to farming. I paid him cash, whereupon he headed north with his gear, and hasn't been seen since. I cleared the ground, put up a shed, and the land became Fort Beaver Landing Field. There was never any question about the title of the land until one day two Weinkel 12 transport planes landed, and out stepped Brindle Jake and his two pilots, Joe Sarton, a tall chap, good-looking in a rugged sort of way, and Tex Ferroni, a slim, dark little fellow. McBain himself is a big, broad-shouldered bloke with odd patches of grey in his hair and beard. That's how he gets his nickname, I'm told. A half-breed French-Canadian named Jean Chicot trails after him like a dog, and I reckon he's McBain's bodyguard. Pretty motley crew, put in Algy. Biggles read on. You can guess my surprise when McBain calmly told me to clear off the land. I can't go into details now, but for the first time I learned that there was some doubt as to the title of the land I bought off Sterling. For some extraordinary reason, there seems to be no record of his having paid the government for it. Angus Stirling told me that he got the land under a settler's grant, but the fact remains he didn't give the transfer to me. However, if I don't own the land, neither does Brindle, although he tries to bluff me he does. McBain built some sheds and started operating to Moose Creek right away. I flew up and saw the traffic manager of the Goldfields Company, a decent little fellow named Canwell, and lodged a complaint, but it didn't get me very far. Canwell's only concerned with getting his stuff to the railhead, and he doesn't care two hoots who takes it, as long as it goes. He as good as told me that in this country it's up to a fellow to work out his own salvation, so that was that. I got my first idea of Brindle's methods when a day or two later, one of my machines shed its wing just after takeoff. Yet I'd stake my life that that machine was airworthy. Brindle or one of his men tampered with it, I'm certain, but of course I can't prove anything. The pilot was killed. I bought another machine and hired another pilot. 2 days later, the new machine went up in flames during the night, and my new pilot packed up and left. I've no money to buy another machine, and the one I have left is a Rockheed freighter, which I fly myself. I sleep in it with a gun in my hand, but I can't stand the strain much longer. I've nearly been killed 2 or 3 times by accident. Brindle wants the aerodrome, but I've told him he'll only get it over my dead body, and that isn't bluff. The fact is, old lad, it goes against the grain to be run out of the territory by a low-down grafter. I'm fighting a lone hand. I'm in this up to the neck, and I'm going to see it through to the last turn of the prop. It isn't just money that matters now. I won't be jumped out by a crooked skunk. So if you want a spot of real flying, flying with the lid off, step right across and give me a hand. We did a job or two together in the old days. Let's do one more. All the best to Algy. Remember that first Hun he shot down? The laugh was certainly on you that time. Yours ever, Wilkes. Biggle's face was set in hard lines as he tossed the letter on the table. How long ago was it posted? Asked Algy. 9 days. Anything could have happened in that time. What are you going to do? Put in Ginger. That remains to be seen, replied Biggles curtly. For the moment, we're going to Fort Beaver as fast as we can get there. Algy, bring up and find out when the next boat sails. Ginger, pass me that directory. I'll send a few cables. We shall want a machine waiting for us when we land, with the props ticking over. Get your bags packed, everybody, and put in plenty of woolen kit. I've never been to Canada, but I seem to have heard that the winters there are inclined to be chilly. Then, let's go and see if we can warm things up, murmured Algy. Exactly 16 days after Wilkes's SOS had been received in London, a blue-winged Jupiter airliner circled low over the cluster of log huts which comprised Fort Beaver. Biggle sat at the controls, Algy beside him, with Ginger braced in the narrow corridor that connected the pilot's control cabin with what normally would have been the main passenger saloon. Behind, amongst the luggage in the rear compartment, sat Flight Sergeant Smith, Biggle's old fitter and sharer of many adventures. They all wore heavy flying kit with the fur outside, for although it was not yet winter, it was already cold, and the annual freeze-up could be expected in the near future. Biggles regarded the landing ground dispassionately as he throttled back and prepared to glide in. I never saw a more desert-looking spot in all my life, commented Algy. What do you expect to find, concrete runways? Inquired Biggles sarcastically. Anyway, is that old Wilkes I can see mending his hut? Algy peered through the side window. Yeah, that fellow's too tall for Wilkes, he declared. And he seems to be tearing the place down, not mending it. Biggles glanced across quickly. The dickens he does. That doesn't look too good. Nothing more was said, and a minute later the wheels of the big machine were trundling over the rough surface of the landing ground, scored in 100 places with tire tracks. Moving slowly and majestically, the Jupiter roared up to where a little group of men stood staring at them from in front of a rough but stoutly built hangar, roofed with corrugated iron. Funny, I don't see Wilkes, murmured Algy. Maybe he's in the air. Maybe, replied Biggles. This is his shed, but there's his company's name board leaning against the wall. Looks as if it's just been taken down. I don't like the look of things, so we'd better leave the engines running in case we want to go up again in a hurry. Tell Smith to come here and take over and keep an eye on us. Let's get out. As the three airmen stepped out from the saloon door, leaving Smith in the control cabin with the engines idling, 4 men walked to meet them. A 5th, obviously an Indian, remained standing near the hangar. One of the four, a little ahead of the others and clearly the leader, was a tall, burly man whose bristling square-cut beard was curiously streaked with grey. He wore a fur cap with flaps hanging loosely over his ears, a check-patterned lumber shirt, and dark corduroy trousers tucked into half-Wellington boots. A broad belt with cartridge pouches thrust through loops was buckled tightly round his waist. The man who walked close behind him was an entirely different type, although he was dressed in much the same fashion. Slight in build, his delicate features might have passed for those of a woman, but for a wisp of black moustache that decorated his upper lip. The fur jacket he wore was thrown open, revealing a beautifully worked Indian belt, through which was thrust a large Bowie knife. Two or three paces behind strolled two other men, their hands thrust carelessly into their trouser pockets. One was a fresh-complexioned man of perhaps 35 years of age, with a fair moustache. His companion was younger, and as swarthy as the other was fair. Remembering the descriptions in Wilkes's letter, Biggles could have named them all. The big man was obviously Brindle McBain. The man who walked close behind him like a dog was Jean Chicot. The other two were the pilots, Joe Sarton, the fair man, and Tex Ferroni, the slim, dark little fellow. Wilkes's descriptions had been brief but singularly apt, thought Biggles, as he walked slowly to meet them, at the same time drawing off his gauntlets. An atmosphere of desertion, almost of desolation, hung over the place. McBain was the first to speak.
$10, stranger.
Biggles raised his eyebrows in surprise. What for?
Landing fee.
Oh, are you the authorized collector for Arctic Airways? McBain's eyes rested broodingly on Biggles' slight frame.
No, I'm collecting for myself.
I see, and who might you be?
McBain's the name.
Ah, mine's Bigglesworth. But aren't you making a mistake, Mr. McBain? This field belongs to Arctic Airways.
Yeah? Well, you're making the mistake. Belongs to me, grated McBain.
Whatever gave you that idea? Inquired Biggles. And nodding curtly, he moved towards what was obviously Arctic Airways' reception office. For a moment, it looked as though McBain would intercept him. He took a pace forward, clenching and unclenching his hands. But then his companion said something to him that the others could not catch, and he stopped, scowling. Algy and Ginger followed Biggles into the office. There was nobody there, although by this time they did not expect to find anyone. Everything was in confusion. Files and papers were strewn everywhere. Algy's face was grim as he looked around.
I don't like the look of this, he said quietly. I'm afraid we've come too late.
Before Biggles could answer, there was a whip-like crack. Several splinters flew across the room, one striking Biggles on the cheek and drawing blood. That was a shot, snapped Algy, then darted after Biggles, who had already flung open the door and was striding white-faced towards McBain and his companions.